Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments, historical what ifs.
I want you to think about something for a moment. That device you're listening on, the one that's probably within arm's reach right now. What if its entire history, its very DNA, was completely different? What if the place we associate with its creation simply never became that place?
That's the question we're tackling today. We're exploring an idea that feels almost unthinkable in our hyper-connected world, a digital age that dawned without Silicon Valley.
It's a topic that really fascinates me, personally. As a writer, I'm drawn to the mythology of the place. The garage startups, the traitorous eight leaving Shockley to found Fairchild, the homebrew computer club, these are our modern foundation myths. I've always been captivated by the idea of what happens to our cultural narrative if that entire chapter is just ripped out.
For me, it's about the mechanics of innovation itself. I grew up just as the personal computer was becoming a reality, and it felt like this magical convergence of military research, academic brilliance at places like Stanford, and that unique, almost countercultural West Coast ambition. You have to wonder, was that combination a one-off miracle, or was it inevitable that some place would become the epicenter?
Exactly. And that's what we're going to unpack. We're not just asking what if about a specific location on a map. We're asking what happens to the very pace and direction of human progress when you remove its most powerful engine from the last half century.
Does the revolution just happen somewhere else? Does it happen slower? Or does it splinter into a dozen smaller, competing visions of the future? The possibilities are staggering.
So, get ready to unplug from the timeline you know. We're about to explore the unseen revolution.
So, to even begin imagining that alternate timeline, I think we have to pinpoint the ingredients, the specific, almost alchemical combination that made the Santa Clara Valley what it became. Because it wasn't just one thing, was it?
Not at all. It was a perfect storm. You had the academic powerhouse, Stanford, deliberately fostering this commercial academic link with people like Frederick Terman. That's the seed.
The seed, yes. And the fertilizer was government money, massive amounts of it. We can't forget that the internet itself, ARPANET, was a military project. That defense spending during the Cold War poured capital and talent into the area for decades.
And then you get that third crucial element, the venture capital, the specialized law firms, an entire infrastructure built around risk. It created a culture where, as the saying goes, you could fail fast.
Which is so different from the established corporate cultures on the East Coast at the time. You wouldn't find that kind of risk tolerance at, say, IBM or Bell Labs in the same way.
Right. But even with all those structural pieces, I keep coming back to the people, the type of person it attracted, and, more importantly, the type of person it didn't, or who it actively excluded. The data on that is, well, it's pretty stark.
It's unavoidable when you look at the history. I was looking at a study, I think it was UC Davis, from back in 2006, and it showed that Santa Clara County had the lowest percentage of female CEOs in the entire state of California. Only about 8.8%.
Wow. The lowest in the state? In the supposed meritocracy?
The very lowest. And that's before you even get to the venture capital side of things or the stories that came out later, like the Ellen Powell lawsuit against Kleiner Perkins. It points to a deep, systemic pattern,
It's a pattern of mythology building, too.
The text we were looking at even cites it. Our iconic tech founders are Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg. That's the template. And when that's the template you celebrate, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for who gets funding, who gets taken seriously.
And that template is overwhelmingly white and male. A 2017 study showed white men holding nearly 60% of executive positions. The next highest group was Asian men at around 16%.
And Black and Hispanic professionals were, what, almost non-existent in those roles?
Essentially, yes. Single-digit percentages, often near the bottom. There was this one account from a Black engineer, LaRon Barton, that just, it really stuck with me. He talked about being the only person who looked like him on his team, being called the diversity hire, constantly having to prove himself.
That's the human cost of those statistics, isn't it? It's not an abstract number. It's a daily reality of isolation and having your skills questioned. It makes you wonder, if the revolution had happened somewhere else, would its DNA have been different? Would it have been more inclusive from the start?
Or would any hyper-capitalist, high-stakes environment inevitably create those same hierarchies and blind spots? I mean, look at what's happening now. The text points to a major shift in late 2024, early 2025. Economic headwinds hit, and what's the first thing to get cut?
DEI programs. The very initiatives designed to fix the problems we're talking about. It's incredibly telling about where the real priorities lie, even after all these years.
It's that phrase, real priorities. Because when the first thing on the chopping block is the program designed to fix a decades-old systemic problem, it tells you that to the people in charge, it was never a priority. It was a feature. Something you have when times are good.
A feature, not a foundation. And that makes me wonder, does that mindset get baked into the technology itself? We've talked about who got to build the revolution. But what about the revolution they actually built? Was it shaped by those blind spots?
Oh, how could it not be? Think about the guiding ethos that came out of that era. Move fast and break things. That is a philosophy born of immense privilege.
Privilege and a lack of accountability, almost. It's the motto of someone who doesn't have to live with the broken things. They can just move on to a next project, the next round of funding.
Yeah. Would a more diverse group of founders, people who have actually been on the receiving end of broken systems, ever come up with that as their guiding principle? I seriously doubt it.
They might have said, move thoughtfully and build bridges, or something that sounds hopelessly quaint to the valley now. But imagine if that had been the core idea. How would something like, say, social media have evolved differently?
That's a fascinating question. If the initial design teams for these massive platforms had included more women, more people of color, people who had been the targets of harassment, would they have anticipated the weaponization of their tools from day one?
They would have had to, because it would have been their lived experience. They wouldn't have seen an open town square. They would have seen a space that needed moderation, safety tools, and clear rules of engagement from the very beginning, not as an afterthought once the damage was done.
It's not just the software, either. It's the hardware. I mean, we've all heard the stories, right? Early voice recognition systems that couldn't understand higher-pitched voices. Facial recognition AI that had catastrophic error rates for people with darker skin.
Because the training data was...
was based on the people in the room. And the people in the room were overwhelmingly white men. It's not necessarily intentional malice. It's a catastrophic, systemic blind spot. It's the result of building a so-called meritocracy on a monocultural foundation.
So the very fabric of our digital world is woven with these biases. It makes you think, if the epicenter had been somewhere else, let's just say Atlanta, with its deep history of Black colleges and a different set of social priorities, what would the killer app have been? Would it have been about connecting college students? Or would it have been about something else entirely? Community organizing, maybe. Or access to capital for underserved communities.
The whole direction of innovation could have shifted. The problems deemed worth solving would have been completely different.
And that's the ghost in the machine, isn't it? The idea that the path we're on wasn't the only one. That the digital world we inhabit is just one possible version, shaped, and in some ways limited, by the very specific culture of the people who built it first.
That phrase, the ghost in the machine, it really is the perfect way to put it, because it's not just a historical curiosity, is it? It's an active presence. Every time an algorithm shows its bias, every time a new platform fails to anticipate its own potential for harm, that's the ghost. That's the echo of those early, narrow choices.
And it leaves me with this profound sense of melancholy, almost. A sadness for the internet we never got. For the digital public square that might have been built with empathy at its core, not just speed. We're living in a world shaped by one version of genius, and I can't help but mourn the versions we missed.
So, the lingering question for me then is, are we stuck with that ghost? Is the foundation so deeply set that all we can do is patch the cracks? Or is there a chance for a do-over, a new epicenter, built on a different model?
You know, I'm not sure a single epicenter is the answer anymore. Maybe that's the old way of thinking. The whole idea of one geographical spot, one valley, feels anachronistic now. The very tools they built, this decentralized network, might be the thing that prevents another monoculture from ever taking root so completely again.
So the great irony is that the solution to Silicon Valley's original sin might be Silicon Valley's own creation. The network itself. Spreading the innovation out. Letting it happen in Atlanta. And Lagos. And Seoul. And Sao Paulo. Preventing any one set of biases from becoming the default for the entire planet.
Maybe. The revolution might finally be decentralizing itself. And in a way, that brings the story full circle. It forces us to ask not what our technology can do, but what kind of world we want it to build. And this time, hopefully, everyone gets a say in the answer. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.